It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
And so
hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to have a lot of shorter segments, but dealing with a variety of topics I believe we should pay some attention to. For example, the mainstream media, both MSNBC and CNN and Fox, and especially Fox, just reported on the fact that John Bolton would be the new security advisor to the president. That's a bad idea. What they did not tell you is what we will. We will give you just a sampling of how nefarious this man's activities have been, and that it's almost a certainty that he will create in the mindset of a person that doesn't even have a mind why war with Iran is a good thing, a preemptive strike against North Korea is a good thing. You'll hear about him, John Bolton. Also, we never talk about pension funds in our society. We should, because upwards of 100 million Americans will be relying upon those, or do now, for their future income. Their pension generally will give them 2 to 3 times more income on a monthly basis than Social Security. What if I told you that the entire pension funds in the United States is completely bankrupt? They will not be able to cover the shortfall, even though some state constitutions state that it is important that these be covered. They must be covered. Well, what happens when there's just no money? How much time do you have before the entire system collapses? At the most, 6 years. So we'll go into that today to show you why you should be very concerned. On our next program, I'm going to take issue once again with the idea that we are a peaceful nation. When we do intervene, it is for democracy and freedoms for the people in that country. I shared my view of how we've killed about 20 million Americans since World War II with regime change. James Lucas, who is a professor, will show that the figure is higher. It's 30 million. That'll be on my next program. Just to put something in perspective, especially for younger people who may not be aware of how dominant this neoliberal ideology is, how pervasive it is. So you'll have that. Also today, we're going to have some audio clips that I think are important. We're going to play one about men. And this is Tucker Carlson. On a lot of issues, I'm on the other side. On this one, I agree with him. I believe he's done a really good job. It's a short piece. It traces the decline of men to disappearance of fathers and why that's important. Also today, favoritism masquerading as equality. Christina Hoff Sommers on feminist double standards. Agree or disagree, we need to hear these voices to open a dialogue to debate the topics. As well as a real firebrand, he is one of the most popular voices in Europe. You never hear him in the United States. Brendan O'Neill, that's O'Neill as in Irish, O-N-E-I-L-L. And he's going to talk about his idea of identity politics. He's calling it fragile, needy, and intolerant. We will then open up for you to have a chance to talk back to that. You agree or disagree in part or whole, but at least it's part of our new series of bringing on controversial issues and having an airing of the issue so we can see what the truth is. Because right now what we have is we have a virtual intolerance to true freedom of speech, mainly by the corporate liberal media in the United States. It doesn't want to hear these discussions because it would interfere with their own ideologies. We've had that for a long time, including in the 1950s going forward by the political right. And they were the ones sponsoring McCarthyism and anti-communism Cold War rhetoric. Well, it's back and it shouldn't be. And they have a lot of young millennials, not the majority, but certainly a group that is engaged in sloganism rather than honest and open dialogue debate. And I don't know if we'll have time, but John Pilger has a piece about why don't believe all the negative Russian propaganda, because it's not true. Let's begin. And this deals with obesity. It's from Cornell University. Now, previous studies have indicated that weight gain can reduce one's sensitivity to the taste of food, and that this effect can be reversed when the weight is lost again. But it's been unclear as to how this phenomenon arises. Now, a study published in the current issue of Open Access Plus Biology, major scientific journal, it shows that inflammation driven by being overweight actually reduces the number of taste buds on the tongue, and that's what happens. Let me just give you a little overview of this. I discussed this at some length on a recent program, but you may not have listened to it. The way we taste food is when we breathe in the pheromones or the scent oils in a food, an onion, a piece of strawberry, whatever it is. We bring that in, and then some of that touches our tongue when we're chewing it, and then that allows each time we breathe to breathe in the full flavor. And that's how we develop an acquired taste. We like the smells, and if we like the smell, we generally like the taste. Well, most common, for example, is cinnamon and apples, apple pie. A lot of kids had that when they were young. That stuck in their mind. That's in there forever. And that's why when we want something to comfort us, when we're stressed out, some dessert from our childhood or something that we ate from our childhood will give us that temporary comfort. Well, the taste bud, and that's why each morning when you wake up, before you drink any water or juice or anything else, you should simply take a tongue cleaner and put it at the back of the mouth and gently stroke the tongue. And what you're going to see is white vicus mucus. It's kind of sticky. And that is loaded with bacteria. And when you clean that off and then rinse your mouth, then you're not taking all that bad bacteria down into your body when you drink in the morning. And that's also where we get a lot of our morning breath, is the sulfur compounds in the foods we've eaten embedding themselves into there, so when we breathe out, the breath coming out of the lungs through the mouth then picks up these pheromones and throws them into the air, hence bad breath. So clean the tongue. And what's going to happen when you clean the tongue? Now you're opening up more of these taste buds for new tastes. Hence, you're going to taste everything better and more distinctly if you clean your tongue. Plus, you have cleaner breath. So a taste bud comprises of approximately around 75 cells. It can be more or less, of three major types, each with different roles in sensing the five primary tastes. And those five primary tastes are salt, sweet, bitter, sour, and what is called umami. But those are the main ones. And taste bud cells turn over quickly, with an average lifespan of just 10 days. And so to explore the changes in taste buds in overweight people, they were given a diet pretty much like the average American diet. And they found that the turnover of taste bud cells normally arises from a balanced combination of programming cells, which is how the cells die, and a generation of new cells from special progenitor cells. What happens is when you're developing new cells, they haven't been dulled yet. So the more overweight you are, the more you restrict these cells from taste. Hence, here's the takeaway message. The more weight you gain, the less distinct are the tastes in your food or beverages. And that's dangerous. Why is that dangerous? Because if you're used to something tasting sweet and you've dulled your taste buds, you're liable to add more sugar in order to get that sweet taste. Also, it'll taste your dull your taste buds to salt, which means, this doesn't taste salty enough. So you'll start adding salt more on, and that's really dangerous. Something simple but important. From Tufts University School of Medicine, Tai Chi, Tai, T-A-I, Chi, C-H-I, is even better than aerobic exercise for managing chronic pain. Now, this is an ancient martial art, similar or actually better than aerobic exercise for people with chronic pain conditions like fibromyalgia. And this was published in the British Medical Journal today. And the findings suggest that it may be time to rethink what type of exercise is most effective for patients with chronic pain. Now, I see a lot of people with fibro, F-I-B-R-O, myalgia, M-Y-A-L-G-I-A. Fibromyalgia is a long-term condition that causes widespread body pain, generally in the musculature, your shoulders, your arms, your legs, lower back. And it can generally lead to extreme tiredness and muscle stiffness and even difficulty sleeping and depression. In fact, about 4% to 5% of the American population has it. You're dealing with about 12 to 15 million people. Now, aerobic exercise is currently recommended as a standard treatment for this. However, now they're saying Tai Chi is actually better. So there was a big improvement in those who did Tai Chi. So there are a lot of places to study Tai Chi. It's not expensive. It's completely harmless to the body. It's actually good for you. From the University of Nottingham in the United Kingdom, they found that lower temperatures, meaning when it's cold, can activate the body's good fat formation at a cellular level. And this was published in Scientific Reports. And it's the first time, at least that I'm aware of, that they found the way that which fat is made within the body is not pre-programmed during the early years of development, as previously thought, but even in adulthood, cells can be influenced by our environment to change the type of fat that is formed. And the work could help us better understand and tackle issues related to obesity and metabolism and develop new ways of controlling disease like diabetes. So the takeaway message is, from this two-year study, that when it's colder, your body will form more of a good fat. A good fat is actually brown adipose tissue, which produces heat by burning fat and sugar and excess calories and helps to regulate blood sugar, or what we call white adipose tissue, the bad type of fat, which stores energy and accumulates it, causing weight gain generally in the abdomen. So brown fat is found most commonly in babies and hibernating animals. That's how they're able to hibernate, as nature's way of keeping them warm while at their most vulnerable. However, in recent years, scientists have discovered that a small amount of brown fat found in adults, and the body then retains the ability to form more under certain conditions. When it's colder, that's when it forms it. Hence, if you live at a higher altitude or colder climate, Canada, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Switzerland, you're going to have less obesity, which is true, and you'll have a healthier fat, and that's also true. And I'm a big believer that women should be getting a regular pap smear, but not just to detect for cervical cancer, which is the primary reason. And supporting that, I see an article today from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and they talked about how pap tests have helped drive down rates of cervical cancer. And a new study suggests they also could be used to detect other gynecological cancers early. So according to the study, tissue and fluid collected during a pap test can detect endometrial and ovarian cancer in women when subjected to genetic testing. And in this new test, that's what they did. So it could be saving thousands of lives a year by catching these cancers at an earlier, more treatable stage. And so that's good. So get your Pap test. It can help. And also, I mentioned yesterday why exercising and not sitting for more than 2 hours at a time without standing and doing some deep bends and toe, heel, up and down, legs bent, could help you. This is the University of Adelaide, which is in Australia. And it says that stopping exercise can increase the symptoms of depression. And that's important because I did a major study. In fact, it was just accepted and published in 2 different peer-reviewed journals. And you couldn't get in the study unless you were depressed or have anxiety under medical treatment and medically diagnosed as clinically depressed or clinically anxious, high-level anxiety, more often than not on medication for at least 3 years. We had 500 people. That's all the place would hold. So we stopped it at 500, which is still a good sample for a longitudinal study. And we met on a regular basis for 3 months. Then we did a follow-up in 3 months. And for those individuals who adhered to the protocol, we had a 93% reduction or elimination completely in anxiety and depression. But this is what also was important because this was one of the unintended consequences. We found that people lost weight across the board. Their body mass index or their fat content went down substantially. Some people as much as 30%, which took them from a danger zone into a healthy zone from pro-inflammatory to anti-inflammatory. Blood pressure dropped. Resting pulse rate dropped because exercise was an important part of it. So this ties into this story at the University of Adelaide that when you're exercising, you're going to be less depressed. When you stop exercising, you're more susceptible because almost no one in the study was exercising. Now, they're suggesting 30 minutes 3 times a week for a minimum of 3 months. We had them exercising 45 minutes to an hour a day, 5 days a week. So I believe they would have found even better results had they gone further. One more reason to exercise, it helps prevent depression or overcomes depression if you are depressed. We're 17 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. Come right back. We have a lot more to share. From our environmental segment today, a new study. Biodiversity scientists warns we are sleepwalking into a mass extinction. Diversity can be damaged in the blink of an eye. By the way, I think it was yesterday or the day before, I read that the last of a particular species, a rhinoceros, a white rhinoceros, is gone off the planet. They're done. They're now looking at one that was in captivity, that they saved the sperm. They're going to try to do something to create some new ones from that. Hopefully they'll be successful. But what does it tell you when all these trophy hunters are now under Trump? Mind you, his 2 sons are trophy hunters. They are now reintroducing, allowing elephants and giraffes, all these animals that are completely harmless to anyone. They're in their own environment. We don't belong in that environment. But to dress yourself up in fatigues and to pay $75,000 or whatever the current rate is and to go out and be 200 yards away and have this high-powered rifle and then you shoot a female elephant, more often than not it's female, that are grazing peacefully, and then you go take your pictures. What kind of person is that? What degenerates? What low life. And now we have a president that supports that. But that's how quickly, when you allow anyone to do anything they want, and they do, and they don't look at the sentientness of any creature. They just look at it as a trophy. Well, that's what's happening. But right now, most scientists acknowledge that we are in the smack in the middle of the planet's sixth great mass extinction. And what they're trying to do now is understand it. Here's the problem with this article. It's too late to understand it. Way too late. We have already passed that the Rubicon. We are now at least 20 tipping points have tipped. The Arctic is gone as far as helping stabilize the temperature of the world's oceans, and methane is being released. The great tundra forests across the northern hemisphere are melting. Methane gushers are coming up. Some of these methane craters are 100 feet across, and massive amounts of methane coming up. Methane is far more potent at global warming cause than just carbon dioxide. You also have the slowing down, impossible stopping of the conveyor belt carrying water that is warm from the tropics up through, coming close to the coast of France and Greece and Spain and Italy, Ireland, England, Scotland, Greenland, and then bringing cold water back. When that stops, you're going to see some really serious consequences over all of Northern Europe. These have tipped, meaning there's nothing in the world we're going to do to stop them. There's nothing we can do to stop having more severe hurricanes, tornadoes, dust storms, sandstorms, drought, monsoons. These have all tipped. There is not a single thing in the world anybody can do to reverse this. And all the while, we have done absolutely positively nothing. So I don't see that we have the capacity intellectually, emotionally, or politically to do anything at this time. I believe that the only time that we will simply wake up is when we're in enough pain. And unfortunately, and this is a terrible thing to think, but we must accept this at some point. No one in life ever changes. Well, there are exceptions, but the vast majority of people never change unless they're in enough pain. So we're not in enough pain. We're not in enough pain to stop racism and work collectively and stop wars and clean up our environment. And we're just not in enough pain. But we will be. Mark my words that in the very near future, I predict within the next 24 months, we will see people in this world suffer from so much pain that we can't hide from it any longer, even though we will do our best to do so. So they're still talking about, quote, we must do more to understand it. Wow. You think? I think you're about 100 years late on this issue. We more than understand it. But the people who understand it best are the people looking at the integrated consequences of this, like Guy McPherson, and he is correct. Unfortunately, I wish he weren't. But I just want to let you know, the next time you hear someone, let's run off to a climate conference, those are all garbage, frauds, worthless, stupid, filled with people who actually think that because they're going, and some of them from Pacifica broadcasting from there, well, what exactly are you doing? And here's what I mean. You who are going over there and broadcasting back and telling people about this meeting and that meeting, are you a vegan? No. Are you buying your clothes from union sources and not from Bangladesh? No. Are you still flying a lot? Did you get over there in a plane? Yeah. Did Leonardo DiCaprio fly back in a private jet from Cannes to pick up an environmental award? Yeah. And then flew back in a private plane? Yeah. Yep. You changing anything in your own life? Nope. I see. Oh, no. No, that's not true. I'm told that 2 weeks ago, someone asked for a paper bag at one of the Walmarts. I'm not sure. I can't confirm it. But that's their lifetime commitment. They got 1 day, 1 second, one purchase at one store, a paper bag. So they must be environmentalists now. Everything we do is an illusion. Everything. There is nothing we do that's real, especially when it comes to an environment. So you have all these conferences. Everything's voluntary, nothing's mandatory, and nothing changes. So we will, but the only way we'll ever change anything is when we're in enough pain. And we're just not in enough pain at any level of our lives now. We're in discomfort. We don't feel good. That's not the same. You got to be picked up like a rag doll and beaten against a wall like a four-year-old kid that doesn't want to play with dolls anymore. And then when you're laying there in shreds and you look up and say, why'd you do that? And that's at the point where you finally get it, that maybe everything you were doing was contributing to the problem that has now overwhelmed you. Harsh reality? You bet. Need to learn it? Sooner rather than later. Will we? No, we will not. Then what's the outcome? You're on your own. Because there's not going to be anyone there. Oh, and if you want to know who's not going to be there, next week I'm doing a show about how all the billionaires and all the people at Davos and all these exclusive enclaves of these megalomaniacs who go and with diminished intellect but very capable of earning money, they're all planning on their doomsday bunkers. But theirs are not going to be, you know, a concrete bunker in someone's backyard with some rifles and some canned food. Now, these people have they're building magnificent places with their own private security systems that they can live there in all the comforts they would normally have. Are we talking about a few, 10, 20, 100, 1,000? No. We're talking about millions. Why didn't we read about this? Well, because no one talks about it. We will. We'll have you on talking about the city in the United States that's underground. You didn't know about it. You've been paying for it for over 75 years. Whole lot of people can hang out there, but you're not invited. Why not? Well, we're going to talk about who is invited to these special enclaves. In case something really goes bad, they have a plan B. What's your plan B? Go to social media and yell to your million, 2 million friends, help? Don't think that's going to work. Now, let's hear from Tucker Carlson. I think that we can learn something from this. Tracing the decline of men to disappearance of fathers.
Well, there are a lot of reasons that men are falling behind in this country, but a look at the numbers reveals one statistic that tracks the decline of American men almost precisely over time, the disappearance of fathers from the home. Between 1960 and 2016, the proportion of kids living with both parents decreased by almost 20%. The percentage of children living with only their mothers nearly tripled. In demographic terms, this is stunning. Changes to family structure this abrupt and profound typically are only seen in wartime. And yet, if anything, those numbers understate the reality of fatherlessness in America. In the high-income neighborhoods where journalists and policymakers tend to live, not a lot has changed. Most kids there still grow up with their fathers and mothers. But in the rest of the country, intact families are disappearing. According to a 2014 study by researchers at Johns Hopkins University, among younger parents without college degrees, 74% of mothers had at least one child outside of marriage. Out-of-wedlock births are now the rule across the country, not the exception. Increasingly, having a father at home is a sign of affluence, but it is also a cause of affluence, especially for boys. Boys who grow up with a father at home earn much more as adults. Boys who grow up alone with their mothers tend to earn less. They also have more disciplinary problems in school. They read less and less well. They're less likely to graduate from high school or go to college. They are more likely to be unemployed and to live in poverty. They get married less often, and when they do, they divorce more. They're more likely to be obese and have asthma. They are far more likely to abuse alcohol and drugs, exhibit antisocial behavior, and commit acts of violence. As adults, they're twice as likely to go to prison. Now, these numbers aren't the result of one study, but of numerous large studies done over generations. The results hold true across geography and ethnic groups. White and black, urban and rural, they're always true. Boys raised without their fathers are at terrible risk. There is not much serious academic debate about that, if any. The nationwide breakup of families is a disaster, and not just a moral disaster, but a practical one. It may be the largest public health crisis that we face. So what's driving it? Well, there are many factors. Falling male wages certainly play a role. Studies show that when men make less than women in their potential dating pool, women tend to consider them less attractive marriage partners. Fewer men marry, more children are born out of wedlock. Some government policies also discourage marriage, particularly among the poor. Women on welfare who marry often see their food and housing subsidies cut dramatically. One recent report found that almost one-third of Americans know someone who hasn't married for fear of losing benefits. Broader changes in American culture have also had an effect on marriage and family formation. The dramatic decline in church attendance and religious observance is one of these. There are probably other reasons, too. Fatherlessness is a hugely complex problem. But the point is, it is a problem, a massive one. And what is remarkable is how rarely that is acknowledged in public. When was the last time you heard a Democratic office holder decry the out-of-wedlock birth rate? If you cared about reducing poverty, you would talk about it a lot, but they don't. Why is that? Well, exit polling answers that question. Unmarried mothers are a critical part of the Democratic coalition. In 2008, Barack Obama won 74% of single mothers who voted. In 2012, he won 75%. Alienating these voters in any way is politically risky for Democrats, and so they ignore the problem entirely. Over time, the progressive left has become openly hostile to the institution of marriage. Once again, voting patterns explain why. It's been more than 20 years since a Democrat running for president won the majority of married women in America. Unmarried women, by contrast, vote overwhelmingly for Democrats. In 2012 and 2016, the Democratic Party platform never mentioned the importance of marriage except when advocating for gay marriage. In 2013, as she was preparing to run for president, Hillary Clinton shot a video tribute to single mothers. Quote, "Single moms are the real heroines," she said. "They need even more of the help that grandparents, aunts and uncles, and good friends can provide." The one group that Hillary didn't mention? Biological fathers. Democrats who stray from this script tend to get attacked. Barack Obama spoke regularly and often eloquently about the importance of fatherhood. And yet, consistent with his party's orthodoxy, he said almost nothing about men marrying the mothers of their children. And that distinction is critical. Studies show that married fathers are by far most involved in their children's lives. You often hear our leaders refer to caring parents or grandparents or caregivers or some similar combination, as if the presence of any involved adult is enough for kids. But that's not true. At least for boys, the presence of a biological father in the house makes all the difference. On at least one occasion, Obama suggested that he understood this. In a 2003 speech about gun violence he gave in Chicago, Obama noted that, quote, "We should do more to promote marriage." Almost immediately, he was attacked from the left. An article in Ebony magazine suggested that Obama's remarks were racist. MSNBC ran an op-ed attacking him, and so on. He went back to platitudes. Hillary Clinton was right about one thing. Being a single mother is difficult. A lot of single mothers work incredibly hard, and they ought to be admired for that. But that doesn't mean that single motherhood is a good idea for society. It's not. It's a tragedy, especially for boys. And the rest of us ought to stop lying about that.
Okay. I believe that we should look at this and examine this and see what we can learn and what we can add to this. Because the studies do show that healthy relationships, happy relationships, end up being very good for the children in that relationship. Toxic relationships end up being very bad for the children. So if you're married, but you're in a bad marriage, you're going to end up adversely affecting the children. I also believe that a lot of our views towards marriage are based upon cultural indoctrination and religious indoctrination. And instead of allowing us to be with the people we care to be with, that we love, and can share something that's essential to both of us, and the children then benefit. Do I believe that a child has a better chance of being raised to become a healthy and aware child into an adulthood if they have both a mother and father looking after them, guiding them, providing some insights and care and discipline? You bet. I've seen it in my own friends. And I can tell you as a single parent myself, for a long time, I had wished that I had a relationship that someone could have also been supportive by being the best they could be in helping in the raising of that child. We do the best we can with the circumstance we're given. But I also believe that there is an awful lot of children out there today who are confused, who lack a sense of true and authentic identity. They've taken on the identity of the single parent and the circumstances in that person's life. And then they act out, not all by any means. We have some outstanding examples of single kids who are happy and growing and balanced. They're in the minority. And I also believe it's time now that we looked at what allows, what is needed, what should we provide to men and women equally so that they are able to work side by side together as equals in opportunity and in respect. I believe this whole idea of demonizing one creates a cost to the other. And we're living in an imbalanced time. I'd like your views. Talk back, coming up in a little bit, 888-874-4888. What would you suggest would be ways that we can help men be healthier and happier? More men are committing suicide than anyone else, and a whole lot of men are committing suicide in their mid to late 40s and early 50s. This has never happened before in these numbers. And kids are committing suicide. In fact, the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. Why? I never had a kid in my hometown that I could recall, nor did my brother, who was 5 years older, nor my father recall that in our entire lifetimes. And now it's just everyday common. So clearly we are not helping the way we should and could. If we would stop just looking at everything through identity politics and look at people as sacred human beings who deserve input. We're now going to hear from a real firebrand. He's a very controversial person. You can agree or disagree. But we need to hear what he has to say and see if we can learn anything or what could we provide to this dialogue that he's saying where he could learn something. And your calls, I intend to send him. Brendan O'Neill on Identity Politics is Fragile, Needy, and Intolerant.
New gender identity. Gender identities are invented every week, pretty much. And there's a new one called aerogender, which shouldn't be confused with aerosexual. Aerosexual are people who are turned on by aeroplanes. Which sounds perfectly sensible in comparison to what aerogender is. Aerogender is someone whose gender changes depending on their surroundings. So this is a person who can be a man 1 minute and a woman the next minute. You know, like, for example, a man who walks into a woman's changing rooms instantly becomes a woman and identifies as a woman. You know, very conveniently, the world molds itself around his or her identity. And I thought, I had two thoughts when I was reading about this aerogender, this changeable gender identity. The first is just how insane it is. You know, you should always try not to pathologize social phenomenon. That's a bad thing to do, generally speaking. But you do sometimes wonder if these people are slightly unhinged. You know, it's the split personality thing and they're describing it as an identity. It is a bit crazy. And my second thought was a more serious one, which is what I think that really speaks to, this idea that your whole gender could change so quickly depending on the room you walk into. What I think that really speaks to is how fragile and hollow and changeable identity is today, literally changeable. It can change at the drop of a hat. And I think that tells us something very important about the politics of identity now. We have this tendency to think, because the politics of identity is increasingly the only game in town, and everyone has to play it, we have this tendency to think it's very strong. It's on the march. You know, the identitarians are marching through the institutions and forcing everyone to buy into their identity claptrap often. But actually, I think the new politics of identity is built on the collapse of real identity and the weakness of people's sense of themselves. And I think that's the kind of era that we're living in. I just want to touch on two things quickly. Firstly, the question of where this new identity politics comes from. And secondly, the question of what we lose as a result of it. So on the question of where it comes from, I think it's fundamentally the corrosion of public life, the corrosion of national life, which gives rise to this new desperate attempt to create new identities, often from nothing, often just utterly invented after reading a blog post and thinking, oh, I feel like that too. You know, it's the demise of the institutions and the ways of life through which people once derived a sense of themselves. It's that which underpins the new kind of scrabble for a new identity. You know, the fall of churches and their influence, of trade unions, of old politics, even of the idea of the nation, which is a very unfashionable idea these days. And as we know, national identity is also in great crisis. The fall of all those institutions, the crisis of all those institutions, means people find it very difficult to know who they are or what they are or what their sense of self is. And that gives rise to this kind of frenetic search for an identity where you patch all these different feelings together and say, whoa, this is who I am. And so what happens is that identity becomes this very insecure phenomenon, very shaky, very insecure, very fluid, which is why you get terms like gender fluid, which, you know, you might think is a fancy term for incontinence or something, but gender fluid is where your gender changes all the time. And I think that idea of fluidity really speaks to the weakness of identity, how unanchored it is in any of the ways of life and institutions people might once have defined themselves through. And you can really see that in the rise of the term "I identify as," which I find a very fascinating term. You know, in the past, people said, I am a Catholic. I am Irish. I am whatever. Obviously, I'm talking about myself, self-obsessed. You were something. I am. It was a declaration. It was confident. You were certain. You knew what you were. Now you say, I identify as, which basically means, I think I'm this thing. I'm not sure. And maybe I won't be this thing tomorrow. It's a very contingent, weak phrase. And it suggests that this stuff can change because you don't really know what you are. You just identify as something because you have a certain feeling. And that changeability was really captured. I read a piece recently about this man slash woman whose identity changes on a daily basis. So one day he is Lauren and the next day he is Larry, depending on what he feels like in the morning. And of course, everyone has to indulge this fantasy. And everyone has to refer to him as he or she, depending on his feeling, which otherwise you are transphobic. And I think it's the weakness of identity politics, which is why it is so intolerant often. That's why on campuses in particular, you're not allowed to criticize certain aspects of transgenderism, for example. That's why the new identity politics is so desperate for validation. They will literally corner you and say, do you accept my identity? And if you don't, you're a racist or a transphobic or a misogynist or whatever else. They need that validation because the new politics of identity is actually profoundly needy and desperate, is constantly seeking approval precisely because it's so weak. And I think that's a very striking thing. Then finally, the question of what is lost as a consequence of the rise of this politics of identity, I think something incredibly important, which is the possibility of any kind of humanist politics whatsoever. That's really what's lost, because what identity, the new identity politics calls into question is the capacity of humankind to move beyond biological categories, to move beyond race, to move beyond gender and sex and all those other things, except where you play with those in a childish, fluid way. What it also contributes is this a very essentializing process where you are defined by your individual identity, your sexual preferences, your race, and so on. And it really calls into question the whole idea that drove the progressive movement for years and years and years, which was that people should be judged by their character, not their color, in essence. That saying that on some American campuses is now considered a racial microaggression. Quoting Martin Luther King is now considered a racial microaggression because it denies people's racial experiences. So what we have is this extremely fragmenting process where people constantly distinguish themselves from others. The new identity politics invites you to constantly distinguish yourself from others, and it's a very separatist idea. And I think actually the idea of checking your privilege, checking your white male privilege, is part of this process of self-distinction. That's really about largely middle-class white men distinguishing themselves from other white men who aren't as switched on and racially aware. So even that has that real process of self-distinction. So my final point would be simply that the problem with this identity politics is that it speaks to the corrosion of all the good things that we might once have defined ourselves through. It makes solidarity and humanist politics utterly impossible. And the way to address this problem of identity politics is not to take the piss out of it, which is really good fun, I know, but is actually to repair public life, because it's the collapse of public life that has nurtured this new politics.
Okay.
Just on the class question, class is not...
Now, he's made several points. We can agree or disagree, but it opens up a dialogue. And I believe one of the most important things for any public forum is to bring ideas forward that we can agree or disagree, extend on, or challenge. It shows the strength or weaknesses frequently of our own highly conditioned minds. Give us your thoughts. You have an opportunity to speak back now, or talk back to Brendan O'Neill. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And I'll be having other controversial people on in the future making statements that you will not hear in the mainstream media. You will not hear because we have censors, and everywhere you have censors. Look, I want to tell you how bad the censorship is. I was invited by Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter, that it is played on this station, to come to the aid of those people in California who do not want mandatory vaccines. They want the choice. And they're not anti-vaccines. They want the choice. They don't want their kid given every single vaccine without looking to see, is this vaccine truly safe, effective? Is there good science behind it? So I prepared a talk, a one-hour talk, with all the scientific literature to support that. And we were ready to go, and this was at a time when there was going to be a vote in 5 days to make it mandatory. And this would have been through a large voting segment of the California population. And the station program director at KPFA in Berkeley censored me and Bonnie Faulkner and would not allow that on. So I wasn't on. And that legislation passed barely. And there is the high probability that enough people would have heard what had to be said and realized that they had been believing only in the official version of the vaccine safety issue and not someone who could challenge it. And as a result now, there's mandatory vaccines and an enormous spike in autism since then in California. And a lot of the people, and I'm not on KPFA in Berkeley, but a lot of the listeners who hear me over the Progressive Radio Network went to the station and protested and actually showed on the side of a building, showed a documentary, The Silent Epidemic, about challenging the legitimacy of vaccines, the science and efficacy. There were hundreds there. But that doesn't count compared to, I appreciate what they did, but think of all the people who could have gotten information they didn't. That's the power of censorship, and that's what I'm opposed to. You can disagree with something, but at least let someone have a chance to say what they have to say. And we're not doing that in the media. And that's unfortunate. Gwen from New York, you're on the air, Gwen.
Hi, Gary. Two really close to my heart issues. I just wanted to make a comment about the marriage issue because I was really surprised to hear Tucker Carlson, because I feel that I'm very far to the left. But I really believe in marriage, and I really believe in it when you have children, because I do believe that, talk about identity politics, I do think that children do identify with the same sex of their parents. And so I don't think that this is a right or left issue. I think that, to me, what's happened, and I live in East Harlem, and I've also run for public office, so I've walked through the schools asking young girls, why is it that when you get pregnant, you don't see any options at all. And they told me, well, abortion is murder. Now, I don't prefer abortion, but I also think that we have let the people that are against abortion talk about it in murder so much that we don't even leave this option open for young women. We also don't, we're also allowing churches, at least in my neighborhood, to come in. And they were supposed to come here about gang violence, but in fact, the conversation turned to sex. But what I also think when it comes to women in marriage is it's not a high self-esteem, it's a low self-esteem. I think the bar has been pushed down so low for girls that they don't even expect that they're going to be asked to get married. And I think that one of the things that the women's group did do was, you know, is I think that they lowered, there is a ritual I believe human beings have. And whether you like it or not, I believe that we're not too different from the animals. We have our ritual, and, you know, it's not really that difficult. But I remember my mother was a big part of the women's movement, and she never told me about, this kind of dance that men and women do. And so, you know, for a long time when I was dating, I would be, you know, sitting at the table, and I'd be pushed to check at the end of the meal, and no car doors open, no walking me to the door at the end of the night. And it really lowered my self-esteem. And later on, I kind of found a little book that helped me out quite a bit. And I ended up getting married and really falling in love. My husband, unfortunately, died almost 2 years ago. But I'm so happy that I had that experience. As a matter of fact, the night before he died, I told him that being married for me was one of the best experiences of my life. I truly loved it. I loved having a partner in everything I did. There was a stability in it. There was a respect. I loved our ritual. I think it's okay that men and women have their rituals. It's really nice to be treated special, and it's really nice to treat somebody special. It's nice to have somebody to care for. So I think this is one of the things that young women don't even see as an option. I think they just feel that they're always going to be treated like a hockey puck. But, you know, the thing is that there has to be women also have to constrain themselves. I mean, I am not a person that believes on sex on the first date. And I believe that there some of this old-fashioned stuff, well, it's been around for thousands of years, and it worked for them for thousands of years. And I believe that restraint is one of the things that, you know, helps keep people glued together, and respect. And I think that many of the boys that I've met that don't have fathers, and I've met a lot of them, including my husband, his father was gone from the picture. And it was very hard on him, you know, growing up. He loved his grandmother, but his mother was very angry, and she took it out on him, and she beat him and hurt him. And, I mean, I'm lucky that he turned out the way he did, but I see it with so many boys in my district that don't have fathers, and they are floating around like not knowing what to do. And I think that if the least that the men can do in our society right now is to join up in some of these programs to mentor young men, I think it would be a really good thing, because I've seen young boys that they just naturally float towards the manly figure. They want somebody to look up to. They want somebody who is like them. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So I think that I just want to say that I'm very pro-marriage. I love it. It was a great experience for me. And I do think that as silly as people can laugh, the book, The Rules, can do a lot of good for lots of people, including, you know, men and women, because I do think that one of the things I realized when I met my husband was he's an old-fashioned guy. He had no interest in me calling him up and asking him on dates. He had no interest in me taking the lead, being the man. He loved being the man, and I loved him doing that. And I don't think that means that I'm anti-woman. I don't think that it means I'm not liberated. I don't think any of that stuff had to do with the workplace. I just think that just like when you go into the wild and you see animals that have their mating rituals, we have ours too. And maybe we should just, you know, pull in a little closer and examine that and be okay with it.
Quinn, I appreciate your in-depth discussion here, and that's why we took it right up to the end of the hour. I thank you very much, and I believe that if you can have a happy, healthy relationship, and if that is marriage or not, either way, it's going to benefit the children. And I think that is what we're missing. What do we have to do to help the children? I'm also a big believer that every man out there who can and every woman out there who can go in and become a big sister or a big brother to help all those that didn't have the advantage of a happy background and are now orphaned. We have over 7 million orphaned children in the United States. We have a responsibility to those kids as well. They deserve a future with love and guidance. And on my next program, I'm going to give you some examples of women and men who should be looked up to as role models because they were. They had character and class. They had dignity and they had joy. They had fun. They were easy to be around. And yet they never once acted in such a way that we see these Beckham, the football player, and some of these other people who do not represent the finest character as role models. And in fact, what happens when you have the wrong role model? So that'll be an upcoming show. Thank you very much, Gwen. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow or on the next program. Have a nice day.